Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast. There are three of us today. I'm Dominic in Amsterdam.
I'm so sorry. I've got some hobnobs stuck in my throat. This is Katie in Paris.
Classic.
And this is Katz also in Amsterdam.
And Katz, you've just moved house. I can see some boxes behind you.
Yeah, but I only moved three doors down. And funnily enough, I just moved in with someone who was in a workshop that Katie and I gave about the Europeans podcast.
And whose studio we've used to record the recent Oatly episodes.
I'm slowly inching in.
Nice way to announce it. So are you two like down the road from each other now, or are you still extremely far apart despite being in the same town?
There's a whole body of water between us still.
And then such a long cycle.
But it's nice that you get to see each other on this video call.
Absolutely. We have seen each other in real life a few times lately, which has been very nice. And I am looking forward to coming down to Paris and imposing myself on you, Katie, at some point to meet little baby.
Yay.
Yes, who is also present on this recording. Apologies, everyone.
No apologies necessary. I absolutely love the sound of a baby gargling, especially this week, considering what's been happening in the country that Katz and I reside in. More on that later. What have we got coming up in the show today, Katz?
Yes, later on in the show, Katie and I will be speaking to Aitor Hernandez Morales, who's a reporter for Politico on the politics of the Iberian Peninsula, particularly on how a very varied array of left-wing parties just united to finally form a government in Spain again. It was a very long negotiation, but they came together to keep center-right Popular Party out of the cabinet. So we'll be hearing more about that later. But first, we are going to hear about a very different political situation, aren't we, Dominic?
Yes, time for good week, bad week.
Good week, bad week.
So, bit of a special edition of Good Week, Bad Week this week, in that both Good Week and Bad Week are coming to you from the Netherlands. Please explain, what's going on over there?
Yeah, well, there was an election last week, which you might have heard. It was quite big news internationally because of the results. So, Katz, shall I bite the bullet and reluctantly give Good Week to far-right populist leader Geert Wilders?
Hooray!
I guess I should give a little bit of an introduction to who this person is for people that have never heard of him. Lucky people. He is the one and single member of the PVV, or the Party for Freedom, which is an interesting quirk. Most political parties usually have lots of members who help control the agenda and have checks and balances. No, this populist decided to set up an association with only Geert as a member, which is pretty terrifying, but he does now have a lot of MPs in Parliament. He won about 25% of the seats in the second chamber of the Dutch Parliament, which is really an extraordinary feat for this populist with a history of explicitly Islamophobic statements. He's compared the Quran to Mein Kampf. He's threatened to ban the book. He wants to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, cut all money going towards green projects. He wants to cut all state money going towards the arts and shut down the public broadcaster, end military support to Ukraine. He wants an exit. It's just a shopping list of far-right extremist policies, basically. And he won.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it was a shocking turnout in just him all of a sudden getting this big. But he's actually been around for quite a long time. He's been in politics for about 20 years. And he even had a case against him because on election night in 2014, he shouted to a crowd of people, "Do we want more or less Moroccans?" And then the crowd cheered less, fewer. And so he's been in a variety of legal cases and is really a sort of well-established political character in the Netherlands already for a long time.
Maybe this is kind of lazy, but I tend to think of him as a sort of European Trump before we had Trump, mostly because he says really objectionable things all the time and has very boofy blonde hair.
Yeah, I have to say, I thought of Trump as like the American Wilders.
Yeah, and there are some pretty obvious comparisons there, but he is also quite a different politician in many ways. And especially during this campaign, he behaved very differently. There was a lot of talk in the Dutch media about how he was running a milder campaign. Although if you read his manifesto, there's absolutely nothing mild about his manifesto. But he did indeed try and present himself himself during the debates as this calmer, more moderate political character. And that was explicitly with the goal to show that he could be someone in government. And it now looks like he might be someone in government. As with all Dutch elections, there's now going to be a long period of coalition negotiations where he'll have to negotiate with various other parties to work out if he can get the arithmetic together to have a majority in parliament. But at the moment, it's looking pretty terrifyingly likely that he will get into power.
Really? I think it's a bit too soon to say that.
Do you?
Yeah.
Hasn't there been some bad news for Wilders already in terms of the guy who was supposed to start making all of these coalition deals with other parties? He's had to step aside, right?
Yeah, he had a very short-lived time as the scout. He turned out to be in a case of potentially embezzling money from Utrecht University, where it seems that 2 million euros disappeared in a project he was involved in, and at least some of it wound up on the account of his wife and two other people he knew personally.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a false start, but another scout has since been appointed, and the conversations have started this week between the main party leaders and this scout. And yeah, we'll just have to wait and see.
The other problem, or the other spanner in the works for Wilders, is that the party VVD, who he would like to have in the coalition, has said that they do not want to be in the cabinet. So it's definitely not a done deal.
Yeah, although they did say they would be willing to support a minority government. So
yeah,
it sounds like you've got a bit more of the optimism that he's not going to make it to the power. I'm feeling slightly more pessimistic that there's no way out.
I don't know if optimism is the right word, because I'm afraid it'll be even more right that a different coalition will come to be. So it's not that I feel optimistic. I just think we're really not there yet.
I was looking in the middle of the night while feeding this loud child at the numbers, though. And there is another coalition that's possible, right? Consisting of more centrists, more mainstream parties.
Yes, there definitely is. The joint ticket between Labour and the Green Left actually came second and had quite an impressive tally of seats.
Yeah, in any other circumstances would have been like a historic and massively celebrated victory by the left.
Absolutely, because it was a year or two ago that it would have been unheard of to think of a left-wing party coming second in a Dutch election. But yeah, it doesn't seem that there's much of an appetite, at least from what I've been reading and from what the commentators are saying, for them to try and create this centrist, centre-left coalition, which in a way, I understand, because if you ignore the will of the people, there was a pretty clear result in this election that this one party were by far the biggest party. Then you can alienate those voters and risk allowing Geert Wilders to get bigger. But on the other hand, giving him power is terrifying. I mean, I really am so scared about this country and about Europe more broadly, actually. Maybe this is a bit too bleak too soon, but I have never felt this existentially terrified about Europe. Not just the Netherlands, because, I mean, if you look at this in the context of what is happening all across the continent with Meloni in power, with Orban in power, with Fico in power, with the threat of a potential Le Pen presidency coming up in France, who knows? And the AfD leading in Germany, the far-right party there. And that's just to name a few of them. There are far-right parties in coalition governments in other countries too. It just feels like, when are we going to find a way to defeat this very easy rhetoric that these right-wing populists have? I mean, I watched quite a lot of these debates and I found it so depressing. Also, how effective the rhetoric is. It's so easy just to blame most of the country's problems on immigrants, even if it's not the reality, but it just blaming someone else is such an appealing thing for people to jump onto. And we really need to find a way to defeat this narrative. And if anyone has any ideas or knows anyone who's writing interestingly about how to defeat populists, then send me an email, because I'd really like to read a bit more about this, because I'm feeling pretty despairing this week.
Yeah, it's really weird. I actually moved to the US in the spring of 2016 and I traveled through during the primaries and then lived there for 3.5 years under Trump. And I'm really reminded of that early feeling of like, a sort of sense of, wow, we really don't know what's going to happen next. And something that I do think is interesting is that both with Brexit and with the Trump election, there was a big reckoning in journalism very shortly afterwards of like, what have we done wrong to sort of allow this rhetoric, a lot of which is not really based on fact, to get this big. And that's not something I'm really seeing here on a comparable scale, because indeed I watch quite a lot of the debates as well. And I was surprised that they weren't challenged more about some of the things that they were proposing, which were really not possible. Like one of Wilders' main statements is an asylum stop. And that's just not an available option while being in the EU. It's against international law. And I was quite shocked to see how little consistent context was given.
I was also a bit frustrated that a lot of the reporting, at least in the public broadcaster, was just about the kind of horse race of who was ahead and who was behind. Mm. And the election really ended up being just about the personalities of these politicians. And I know that's not unique to the Netherlands. That happens all over the place. But I really think that if more people had actually read the manifesto of the Party for Freedom, his party, I think some people at least would have been like, oh, actually, I don't think 14-year-olds should be treated as adults in criminal cases. Mm. I don't think we should cut all funding to the arts. I don't think we should leave the European Union.
Yeah, which is, by the way, a really unpopular opinion in the Netherlands. I think 80% of the Netherlands wants to stay in the EU. So if he organized a referendum, which he says he's going to do, it would be very unlikely that Nexit would win.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable just like on the evening before the elections, how little we knew about what these parties actually wanted to do about some quite concrete things.
There's one other thing about this election that I wanted to mention. One other terrifying thing, which is that Geert Wilders won amongst young people.
Right. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I don't really know, to be honest, but it's something that we're seeing in other countries too. I know in the USA, early polls are suggesting that Biden and Trump are also tied at the moment amongst young people. Mm-hmm. And people are quite surprised that populists seem to be doing well with young people. And there was this high school election in the Netherlands where it's like a fake election where they get hundreds of thousands of teenagers to vote. And they voted for the two far-right parties as the biggest two parties.
Wow. Oh, that's scary.
And it is scary because I've always been brought up with thinking that young people are just like inherently a bit more progressive. And that's changing. Mm. And yeah, there needs to be a lot of analysis done as to why that is. And I don't know, I mean, my immediate ideas are that maybe it's got something to do with social media and the fact that Wilders and Baudet, one of the other far-right leaders, are quite TikTokable and say nice, easy, sometimes even funny things that can be easily made into a 15-second TikTok video.
I did see a report today as well that said that like literacy of how democracy works is really going down and is quite low in the Netherlands compared to some of our neighboring countries. And I wondered if that had something to do with that sort of younger trend.
Yeah.
Because they probably wouldn't recognize that a lot of what they're suggesting is unconstitutional.
So I'm sorry, this is supposed to be Good Week, Bad Week.
Yeah, so we were carried away.
Please remind me, who are you giving Good Week to and who are you giving Bad Week to?
Oh, it's so messy. I think we're just going to have to leave it in this chaos. But I will say that something that's been on my mind a lot this week is I really can't imagine what it's like to be Muslim Dutch or Moroccan Dutch right now, with such a huge win for a party that has been so explicitly Islamophobic. I've already been seeing reports of mosques having to increase their security, and I think that's a really sad day for the Netherlands when people feel that unsafe in their own country. Mm. And I think it is also a bad week for the EU, with a leader that is so openly anti-EU. The previous PM, Rutte, was quite pro-EU. And he's, you know, he's against things like the EU Green Deal. He also is against sending weapons to Ukraine. So it's going to be really quite a massive shift. But apparently it's very good news for people like Orban. Yay!
Yay!
Yeah, the Netherlands was a founding member of the EU and has traditionally been quite like a strong pro-European country. So I imagine the political earthquake was felt in Brussels this week as well.
So what is this? Bad week for the Netherlands, worst week for Europe?
Yep, that's what it is.
Fun.
Yeah. As I mentioned in our last episode, it's not been the easiest few months financially for this podcast, and we are doing our best to scramble together a budget for 2024. And I was genuinely really moved by how many people responded to our somewhat desperate call for help.
Yay!
Thank you so much. We are sending a ton of gratitude to the following people: Sonia, Austin, Rosa, Trace, Mary, Jonathan, Susanna, Marek, Esther, Katie, Mark, Amanda, Javier, and Bill.
Wow, that's so many.
Thank you all so much. And thank you also to Fraser, Kirk, and Rebecca for increasing your donations. We could not do this without you. If you'd like to join them, then head to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
So coalition building is kind of a sport in Europe, and whatever government you guys end up with in the Netherlands, it's probably going to take you ages to get there.
Yep.
And in the other country that you follow very closely, Katz, Spain, where you used to live, they've just managed to cobble together a government after months of coalition talks, right?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, especially watching the debates. The left in the Netherlands was so unaligned, like one of the other center-left parties, D66, really bashing Frans Timmermans for not being strong enough on climate. And he was, you know, the person that put the EU Green Deal together with many others together. So I thought that was really wild to see them not aligning on this. And meanwhile, I was following what was happening in Spain. And there, the left very much aligned, pretty much to keep the right-wing leader out of government. And a very unlikely coalition was formed with some pretty varied parties. Mm. And so it is, again, Pedro Sanchez, leader of the Socialist Party, who is keeping his position as the Prime Minister of Spain. It is a very different situation than what just happened in the Netherlands. And so we rang up Aitor Hernandez Morales, a reporter for Politico, to find out more.
When these elections were called a few months ago, I remember Dominic asking what the logic was of calling early elections when you're behind in the polls, which Sanchez was at the time. I mean, it seemed like a crazy thing to do. And here we are 6 months later and a new Sanchez government has just been sworn in. How did he pull this off?
Well, it really is a remarkable turn of events. When Sanchez calls elections at the end of May, his party has just suffered a devastating defeat across the country. There were local and regional elections in which the socialists lost control of every major Spanish city. They've only retained Barcelona, and that's basically because the center-right Popular Party agreed to support them so that Catalan separatists would not take the mayoralty. What we see here is an incredible gamble. Basically, the idea is that if elections are called for the summer, the campaign will take place at the same time that the Popular Party is making deals at the local and regional level with the far-right Volksparty. Even though the Popular Party was the most voted party, it didn't achieve a majority in any of these places. Its only route to power was to make these deals with the Volksparty, which does not believe that violence against women is a thing. It is contrary to LGBTQ rights. Independently from picking just a very good date to hold the election, I think the defeat in May really woke Sanchez up. He realized that even though his government's policies had been broadly popular among the public, his government and him in particular just had a terrible image issue. So one of the things that he did was completely change his communication strategy and start engaging with everyone. He started appearing on podcasts, on morning shows. He went to radio shows with hosts that he knew hated him. He engaged with everyone and brought out his most charming side. But more than anything, he made a play both for consolidated groups like women who are historically socialist voters. And then he made a very unusual play for the youth vote, which in Spain historically had gone to far left parties. And he started appearing on these youth-oriented podcasts and just being like kind of this cool dad.
The cool dad of Spain. The Spanish left has gone pretty far to come together in this election and in this government. That's something we've struggled to see elsewhere in Europe. And I'm wondering what made them do that.
Yeah, so I think that Sanchez's victory can only be understood by that unification of the left, but also because, frankly, the center-right just was remarkably bad in their campaign, and the center-right leader was unable to basically explain his tendency to tell mistruths. He was called out, and I think that really hit his reputation. Once the elections happen and it becomes clear that even though the Popular Party has scored the most votes, it does not have enough seats in parliament to actually form a government, that's where we see this unification of the left. The left realized very quickly that it was either forming a coalition government around Sanchez or alternately accepting new elections where it would be possible for the Popular Party to get its ducks in a row and for it to form a party with the far right. And we especially heard that this last week when we had the debate prior to Parliament giving Sanchez approval to form a government. One after one after one, these MPs belonging to these minor far left or separatist parties said clearly that they were voting for Sanchez, not necessarily because they felt particular affinity for Sanchez, but rather because they did not want to accept the other option. And one of the MPs, Gabriel Rufián, who belongs to the Republican left of Catalonia, said it very clearly, looking directly at Feijóo, at the opposition leader. And he said, the only reason why you are not becoming prime minister is because of you, not because Sanchez is particularly brilliant. And he basically was telling him there that his insistence on palling around with the far right would prevent the Popular Party from ruling Spain anytime soon.
Yeah, I am wondering, though, what do you think made the stakes so clear for the left parties and also for their voters? Because you could say this about any country. So what made that really land?
I think that certainly for the quote-unquote conventional far-left and regionalist parties, so for example, the Basque Nationalist Party, it was such a clear decision simply because Vox, this far-right party with which the Popular Party would have had to have ruled, that party has said clearly that it wants to get rid of regional autonomy in Spain and that it wants to undercut a lot of the rights that these regions have. So for them, it really was an existential threat. For the far left parties, Vox's positions on social issues, for example, violence against women or the rights of the LGBTQ community, that for them was the absolute red line where they said there's no way that we could ever back a government that would be willing to make deals with these people. More broadly, I think that the big conflict in Spain, of course, has been the support of Junts. Junts is a Catalan separatist party. Its de facto leader, former Catalan president Carles Puigdemont, was the person who led the failed Catalan independence referendum in 2017. And as you guys probably know, he fled Spain and has been living in self-declared exile in Belgium since 2017. He's a member of the European Parliament, and until now he's had immunity, but that immunity is gone. Now, he is still sought by Spanish authorities, and so getting his support, which was crucial for Sanchez to be able to become president in this hyper-fractured parliament, that was tremendously difficult. We always knew Puigdemont would ask a high price for that, and that price was amnesty for him, but also for all of his followers. At least 300 people, in some estimates, it could even go into the thousands because a lot of people have been prosecuted for their involvement in the Catalan independence movement just by virtue of being mayors where referendums were held, or even in some cases, firemen who were trying to guarantee security at these events. It is really important to take into account that there is no legal precedent in Spanish democracy for this. The last amnesty law that was passed in Spain was back in 1977. And that means that law is always going to be on very shaky ground, and we'll have to see if the Spanish courts ultimately deem it strong enough to be approved. It's a tough pill to swallow for Sanchez. This issue is extremely divisive. There are many Spaniards who consider that that referendum was a personal affront to them, you know, a region that's breaking off from the rest of Spain and refusing to let them be part of that process of deciding. Is it going to have an electoral cost for Sanchez? Yes, absolutely. That said, is it something that ultimately voters need to come to terms with? Yes, I expect that Sanchez will continue presenting this as a lesser evil because it helped keep the far right out of government.
This is a minority coalition.
Yes.
How likely is it that this government just collapses?
It's difficult to argue that it would collapse simply because the only way that governments can collapse in Spain is through a censure vote. And you would need a majority of parliament to sign on to that. So you would need the conservatives and the far right to somehow convince a lot of far left and regionalist or separatist parties to join them in voting Sanchez out. I don't see that as being possible. What I do think is that it is going to be a government with a huge, huge challenge when it comes to passing legislation. These are parties that are fundamentally different. If you just look at, for example, the Catalan sphere, what you have are two separatist parties. Officially, sure, they both want separatism and they both just back Sanchez. But when you get into the nitty-gritty, these are parties that have fundamentally different views on socioeconomic issues, and it's going to be incredibly difficult to get them to back any sort of draft legislation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that bringing these parties together could really bring Spain together?
I think it's going to be a very complicated period for Spain. I do believe that Catalan separatism is not what it was 6 years ago. This was one of the lingering open wounds. And by passing this amnesty, many argue that Sanchez is actually robbing the movement of its martyrs. And that ultimately will help deactivate it even further, because no longer can people be, you know, protesting in Barcelona saying, you know, let our leaders come home. If they're already home and they can run for elections, that's their own problem.
Mm. There have been some pretty massive protests across Spain in response to this deal. And I've been seeing some pretty disturbing footage of people making Nazi salutes and also singing Franco-era fascist songs. Can you tell me a bit more about what's going on there?
Yeah, so these protests have mainly been going on in Madrid in front of the Socialist Party headquarters. And they've been going on for about 2 weeks now. The initial ones really drew a lot of people. I was in Madrid at the time, and it was pretty shocking. And there certainly was a palpable tension in the city. Those have gradually been dwindling. And the people that keep coming out, as you say, are hardcore far-right supporters. I do think that this is opening up a wound that is going to be very difficult to close for Spaniards outside of Catalonia. I think the news of the amnesty has actually been received with kind of a shrug in Barcelona. I was there the day that the bill was filed, and the reaction I saw from both political leaders and people on the street was one of, cool, great, but this doesn't really change my day-to-day. In Spain, meanwhile, the reaction was this drama, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing this. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon. I also think that the government is going to have a challenge in that this law will take a very long time to make it through parliament, and then it's going to be challenged in the courts, and it's not going to be settled, I would say, probably this year. And while that's open, the Sanchez government is going to have to deal with it day after day and deal with the questions from the media and deal with the arguments in the parliament. So I think they have a tough year ahead, and a year where a lot of people are going to be very upset.
Nonetheless, I thought it is slightly more hopeful than what's going on in this country. So I really appreciate it. Thanks for talking to us.
I really needed that to hear about a country where there isn't just an inevitable slide towards right-wing populism. So thank you, Aitor, and thank you, Katie and Katz, for speaking to him.
Yes, thank you very much, Aitor. He produced a truly astonishing amount of news between Portuguese government falling and this very unlikely coalition in Spain coming together. So I can highly recommend going to read his reporting and also his tweeting, and there will be a link in the show notes.
I particularly enjoyed this thread that Aitor did about the briefcases that Spanish government ministers get. I now really want one of these briefcases. I wonder if I can find one secondhand on eBay.
I mean, they must have loads of them.
They're very fancy.
Welcome to the Inspiration Station, where we talk about cultural goodies from across Europe.
What cultural goodies have you been enjoying this week, or have you been watching or listening to?
I went to the cinema and I saw a really excellent film, The Anatomy of a Fall.
Oh, so good.
I've seen this advertised on the Metro.
It's so good. It's a courtroom drama, essentially directed by the French director Justine Triet. And it stars the formidable German actress Sandra Hüller, who was in Tony Erdmann a few years ago. I don't know if any of you saw that.
Oh, yeah.
She was also excellent in that. And it's an absolutely thrilling screenplay that tells the story of the suspicious death of the husband of a well-known novelist played by Hüller. And it's asking the question, did he fall, did he jump, or was he pushed by his wife? And the thing the film does so cleverly is that it leaves the audience guessing, not quite sure if the film's protagonist is innocent or guilty. And this ambiguity makes the film so tense and dynamic. Hüller is amazing in it, as is the boy who plays her son, who is partially blind. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes earlier this year, and it also won the Palme Dog for the excellent performance of the show's lead dog, Snoop.
I have reported on this award before. Very important. I met some very nice dogs.
It is the most important award handed out at Cannes, in my opinion. There was actually some surprise that it wasn't selected as France's submission for the Best International Oscar. I read an article in Variety which cited some French cinema insiders wondering if the film was being snubbed by the committee because of the director's fiery political speech she gave at Cannes.
Ooh, juicy.
In which she criticised Macron's neoliberal government for commodifying culture in France.
Oh.
Remember that drama.
So who knows? But even without the potential Oscar nomination, it's one of the biggest box office hits of a winner of the Palme d'Or in recent history. And I think that box office success is very well deserved. So I recommend you go and check it out.
Can't wait to see that.
Yes, I watched it too and it was brilliant.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah. And I felt so uncomfortable afterwards. Trust, it's so hard.
Oh, I know. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I wanted to recommend a book that I have been consuming in audiobook form, Treasure Islands. It's by the British journalist Nicholas Shackson, but it concerns several European countries, actually, in that it is a history of tax havens around the world and the story of how tax evasion became this huge, huge part of how the global economy works. And this book is like absolutely fascinating. I have been lapping it up. And it's going to sound kind of crazy, but I think if aliens landed on this planet tomorrow, I really think that tax havens would be like a crucial thing to explain to them about how the human economy works. And it sounds really boring, a history of tax evasion. But like, honestly, there is a jaw-dropping anecdote every few minutes in this book. It's also really interesting in how it describes how European colonial powers, after they lost their land empires, they built these financial empires, especially Britain, using these like semi-dependent territories in the Caribbean and elsewhere, where just like vast, vast amounts of money passes through, a lot of it dodgy money. Yeah, can't recommend this book highly enough. It is called Treasure Islands and it is by Nicholas Shackson.
Sounds great. And can I recommend one more thing, please? Sorry.
Oh, scandalous.
But as you heard earlier, it's been a very tough week in the Netherlands for a lot of people. And one group who are feeling very scared about the win of the far right are artists. I actually found out about the result while I was rehearsing at the National Opera House here. And there were people around me just immediately saying, okay, what else can we do? What other jobs are there? It was like quite bleak.
I happened to run into someone who works with Mohammed, who we made an episode about and with. And she told me that immediately she got calls all day from people in their asylum seeking processes, ringing her up and saying, what's going to happen now? What's going to happen now? Which I thought was very sad.
Yeah, it's a destabilizing time for a lot of people. So forgive me for recommending a Netherlands-specific thing now, but I wanted to briefly recommend an exhibition that's opening on December the 9th at the Photography Museum in The Hague. It's called Ordinary People, and it's a retrospective of the work of Dutch photographer Rob Hornstra, who's been photographing Europeans in everyday situations for a long time. It will feature some pictures from his collaboration with writer Arnold von Brugge, which is very controversially called The Europeans.
No, those thieves.
In one of the most controversial stories across the continent.
Right. It looks like it's going to be really nice. And yeah, the Europeans, the other Europeans, they've received support from our friends and partners at the European Cultural Foundation. So go and check it out if you're in The Hague anytime before spring 2024. Let's support our artists.
Yes, please.
I have a cute little happy ending for you all from the city of Luleå in the northernmost county of Sweden. As with many parts of the world, there is a growing problem of loneliness in Luleå. And to counter this, the city has launched a sweet campaign to help people out. The campaign is called Say Hey, meaning say hi, and is simply a campaign to encourage people to say hello to each other on the street. Aww. And this might sound like an insignificant intervention into a big problem, but according to the city, there is actually quite some research that shows that small interactions in the street with strangers can make a big difference to the feeling of well-being and safety that are often connected to loneliness. The city is placing adverts around the city and even running workshops in schools. And even though I don't live in Luleå, I'm going to make a bit more of an effort to say hello to strangers in the street. Let's all say hey.
Dominic, you can't do that in a city. People don't do that. You'll look crazy.
Actually, that's one of the things I missed the most during the pandemic was those random interactions. It was so nice when they came back, just like little conversations with strangers.
This is going to really mark me out as someone that lives in an urban centre now, but I really do get a thrill. You know, when you're in somewhere like a rural area and somebody says hello to you and you say hello back and it's really nice.
And you look a bit like a crazy city person because you're like, hi. Call me a big old cynic from all of these elections, but it's like, on the one hand, we have a far right leader. On the other hand, say hi.
Yeah, right. But, and I know you say that like flippantly, but actually the thing I did after this election was I decided I'm going to be really nice to everyone.
No.
I felt like that's the only thing I can do is like being nice to strangers. Mm. So going into a coffee shop, being super nice to the waitress there, being really nice to just anyone you interact with. I feel that it's a bit pathetic, but I feel like it's the only way we're going to get out of this mess.
I do get that. I mean, that was something that's really striking and maybe a bit unifying in a sad way of the electorate is how many people are not feeling listened to. Mm. So maybe that is the best thing you can do.
Happy ending! That is all we've got time for this week. Next week, we're going to be in the very capable hands of Wojciech Oleksiak, one of our producers who's been working on a very special episode. But in the meantime, if you miss us, you can head to social media to see what we're posting. Very interesting things, I promise.
Instagram at Europeans Podcast, Twitter or X, whatever it is these days, at Europeans Pod, and the new one, Blue Sky.
Europeanspod.bsky.social.
Send us an email.
Or send us an email, indeed. hello@europeanspodcast.com. This week's episode was produced by Katz Laszlo. Thank you, Katz. And the interview was produced by Katie Lee. Thank you, Katie.
Very welcome.
See you all next week.
Bye. Do we?
How do?
Emba dunk.